very welcome this morning. The topic that I've announced is the question, does art make the world a better place? And I'm specifically sort of zooming in on the question whether there's a kind of redemptive quality to art. And my answer, plain and simple, is yes, but probably in a somewhat different way than the average modern Westerner would tend to approach this question. I have a few concerns, which you will hear me somewhat philosophically try to articulate. Fortunately, we're dealing with art, and so we're going to get a whole bunch of visuals that help us see some of the things that I'm trying to communicate on the way, which will make philosophy light. I really do believe that this combination of ideas and their impact being made visible and embodied, you might almost say incarnated, is a very golden sort of zone. It helps us understand the world better. Those of you who know me a little bit better know that I'm involved with an initiative called the Blaue Kuppel, the Blue Chamber, which is working towards integrating curricula and school systems and maybe more broadly worldview and art and art history. Can I ask that I don't have too much crossing over, especially with the wires here? That's going to be concerning thing. Anyway. Hey, thank you. Thanks, Rob. Okay. My examples are primarily visual art, especially Schilderkunst, painted art. I'm going to start with a different kind of example, just because one can apply what I am saying to art in general and not just to visual art. Last night I was in the car driving to Utrecht, and on the radio I heard the advertisement for a Syrian musician who is going to do a sort of benefit concert to raise money for the victims of the earthquake in Turkey and northwestern Syria. It's the region that she herself comes from. And the interviewer was asking the person that was organizing this concert, great, you guys are raising funds, etc., but does the music also have some sort of special role or something? And the guy gave a wonderful response. It was a very clumsily formulated question, but the answer was wonderful nonetheless. Of course, music comforts. Muziek geeft troost. And music comforts, and it connects people. And guess what? Both these things are radically true about the potential. Music can indeed bring deep comfort and connect and bind people. And I've experienced this at various moments in my own life. Now, I wanted to include one other anecdote, and that is a link to this. In high school, I went to boarding school. Boarding school was not always an easy place to be. And especially in the last phase, slightly machismo South Africa, boys' environment, boarding school, real men don't cry. At least that's the narrative you hear from around you. And so I hid my tears, if those were there. And if you hide that kind of thing long enough, they go away. And so I ended up in my first year of university, somewhere towards the end of my first year, something happened of which I knew I should have cried about this. This was significant loss. And my emotions were not primary anymore. I could not. And the crazy thing is, we don't have a button with which we can turn tears on or off. If you discover that you're not crying for something you should have been crying for, it's not like there's an easy solution. Where do you find your tears? I was rather worried. You know, have I lost my empathy? Have I become a stone? And anyway, in the subsequent months, and it was quite a journey for me to figure out where were those emotions. And the first time I came close to tears was during the watching of a movie about a topic that I had lots of personal experience related to, in the dark, big theater, and especially a soundtrack providing a kind of turbocharge. It's almost like wind blowing on the emotional heartstrings. And you see what art is capable of. There's a certain access to our emotional states in the case of narrative, image, sound all together. And anyway, my journey back to finding where my tears were started in the movie theater. And I looked for that zone consciously and let it happen at moments. It was a safe place to slowly rediscover my tears and over time reintegrate them with my everyday experience. I'm thankful for this potential of art. So my short answer, does art make the world a better place? It certainly can, but there's a risky thing here, and that is that if we elevate art into a kind of religious zone, if we start talking about art not as a place where redemption can be expressed or something like, but as the redeemer, or, you know, as the source of redemption or something like that, then we situate it in a position it shouldn't have, it doesn't deserve, and can be quite destructive. Now, to illustrate the zone that I'm talking about, I took this little screenshot of a British Journal of Aesthetics article published in 1998, around the turn of the century in the millennium. Mr. Whibley is writing The Redemption of Art. And he's zooming into Iris Murdoch, a fairly famous thinker, and says the following. It is hardly striking that Iris Murdoch has an elevated view of art. She is, after all, both a novelist and a philosopher, an artist who believes the artistic enterprise is the best means of conveying goodness to a secular post-Christian world. Take note. Iris Murdoch is not necessarily a Christian thinker or anything like it, but does see that in a post-Christian world we've lost some of the roots that used to provide goodness. Art takes the place of science, philosophy, and religion in making truth accessible to the person in the street. It is a high substitute for the spiritual and speculative life. Yay, art! And I start to feel a little uncomfortable. I start to get worried. You'll read when he goes on. Yet surprisingly, Iris Murdoch also writes as a Platonist. You know, the Platonists had this dual view. You know, the ideal world of the spirits, etc., and the forms, and then the physical, material, the more shadowy part, as far as Plato was concerned. Which is problematic, since Plato clearly believes art is beyond redemption. This difficulty inspired, and it goes on, and just to give you a sense of Plato's view, I'll quote from here on at the bottom of the page. Plato has a layered critique of art. At one level, his objection is an ethical one. Art does not promote moral rectitude. Art, in and of itself, doesn't necessarily make us morally better, says Plato. Maybe he's right. The offerings and images of the artist are baneful. Now, here you might beg to differ in the other direction, but he says, you know, banality, as in it draws us down to the lowest common denominator, that kind of sensation. And that has to do with the fact that Plato situates art in this material realm. Art is typically expressed in material stuff. And so and maybe the definition of art as he's using it is closer to what we might call artisanal activity. So it's not maybe art like we are used to in the museums per se, but artistic expression nonetheless. Plato is a little worried about it. Because they possess, artworks, possess the power to infect the moral well-being of the nation's youth. And he goes on. Now, this is a Platonic a concern about the power of art. So he recognizes it's powerful, but he sees that it can be used in a negative way. And I would say, indeed, art has very powerful potential, access to our emotional life, as I was telling with my anecdote. But the question is, which direction is this gun pointed? Is it in a good direction or a bad one? This powerful thing we're talking about. You know, if I think about, let's take some of the music videos I've seen over the course of the last 25 years or so, I would have my doubts whether they were, uplifting, as you hear, the text encouraging violence, sexism, racism, etc. Those options are out there, and we do hear them in various forms. Not only, fortunately, but also. And so it's not a clear picture. Now, this Platonic view is not the only view that the classics had. By the time, about 3rd century AD, Plotinus comes around, you've had a transition where art has moved from this lower material level to the more conceptual perspective, where all of a sudden art becomes part of this ideal, you know, the perfect realm, which brings us in a kind of mystical connection with the divine and so forth. So in Plotinus, a very high view of art is born, which has a massive impact on Western thought, especially back when in the Renaissance, we grab back to that which was before the medieval era. Now, many of you will know that Hans Rookmaker, this man, was involved with the founding of Dutch Libri and had a lot of influence in our sphere here. He was also an art historian at the Free University in Amsterdam. And he held an address in 1965 at the moment when he was accepting the position of Hoogleraar, professor at the Free University. And let me just check the date to be sure. Indeed, yes, 28th of May 1965. At the Faculty of Letters at the Free University. He gave his lecture at that moment the title, "The Artist as a Prophet," with a big question mark attached to it. A sort of overview of this idea of the artist as prophet, which I think he correctly identifies as something that hangs in the air of the 20th century. He makes the observation, it's not for the first time in history that we've had this high positioning or evaluation of art. Already in the time of Plotinus, 3rd century AD, one has this connection between the artistic and the mystic and this very high evaluation of art. And he points towards this Renaissance recapturing of this pre-medieval ideal when they grab back to this classic era of the Greco-Roman world. Plotinus is picked up again, and he does say that in the Renaissance, you don't yet have this sort of almost religious respect for art fully. He says it's more a question of, let's say, the arts world finding a place in this higher layer along with the carriers of culture, the poets, and the intellectuals. wrestling for a place to stand in the line of the, let's say, the top layer that are busy with, you know, the ideal things, the forms. In the Renaissance, the ideal and the form was very important. So, yeah. You have this lifting up of visual artistry into a higher appreciation, but it is not yet a full on, let's say, almost religious respect, you might say. Now then, after the Renaissance and Baroque, you get the 17th, 18th century, and what you might call a classicist theory. I'm going to read a few, or translate a few words here. At the end of the 18th century, there's a kind of counter-reaction against this classicist tendency, the art theory of the 17th and the 18th, where there was a great emphasis on the formalism of art, the way that art was made. You need to think of the time of Mozart. The other day I was letting some of you hear the music of Mozart or of Shakespeare. This was a time frame when the sonnet was invented as a sonnet. Defined what kind of a thing is a sonnet, or a concerto in the music sense. Yeah, if I'm playing the clarinet concerto, the concerto was conceptualized in the classic time frame. It was a rather headstrong, you know, please no parallel fifths in the musical sense, all sorts of rules and regulations for how you're supposed to do your art, etc. It was a rather headstrong time, slightly less emotion and slightly more form. And then you get the counterblast against this as we enter the Romantic era, Enlightenment heading into Romantic, and you get in this Romantic, sort of resurgence of the Renaissance ideal. You get a more solid division, and he calls it like a dividing up of the inheritance of the upper and maybe we should say more the academic intellectual and the more emotional content type stuff, and each gets its highly respected part of that upper area. And this division into two parts is a precursor to art being a source of truth of a fundamentally different kind than of science. And so you get two kinds of prophetic voices, which to this present day are impacting society. The scientists who tell us, you know, how the things really are, and the artists who intuit and see and interpret and give us access to deep truths. And so is born a time frame when in art, it becomes very important for the artist, not like you had, for example, in the medieval time frame, artworks where the emotion of the one that you are painting is at the center, but now the emotional output and experience of the artist becomes central. So you have this subtle shift taking place. Anyway, he goes on to say the artist became a prophet, a high priest, and at the very least, a spiritual leader of humanity. He goes on to argue this in a lot of detail, which I don't have time to get into. But we get a place where, a certain view of art comes about, which is felt as a pressure by people who are busy with artistry and studying art to the present day. You know, if you go to an average Kunstopleiding, an art education these days, you will very quickly be thrown into the deep end of needing to have some profound message without anybody telling you exactly what that should be, and feel this great burden to not just simply, you know, use the talents that you've developed as a child, enjoying, you know, observing well and drawing nicely or something like that. No, you need to delve into some great deep source out of which you can, you know, delve up deep truths and insights about the universe. I exaggerated a little bit, but I know a lot of young people, I've seen them come through Libri, and I kid you not, there's a lot of pressure felt by people busy with visual art these days. No doubt about it. And it's a pressure which goes back to this, you know, very, very high prophetic ideal that seems to have been attached to the endeavor of artistry. Now, the philosopher Schopenhauer, he picks up this new vein and makes it take note of the dates, 1788 to 1860, so, you know, well slap bang in the middle of the Romantic era, and he elevates the artist to one that brings revelation, and that's revelation with a capital letter, who's revealing, you know, the divine ultimate truths about life. I could say much more. You have people like Goethe, Schiller, etc. Many German artists who are, you know, sort of rotating around this idea that there's something, revelatory, revelation-like in artistry. But not all is well in the land of artistry. Enter Nietzsche, the turn of the century, just before the 20th century is born. One of his earliest works was a book, a treatise called The Birth of Tragedy. He wrote it in 1872. It's a very early work for Nietzsche, a seminal work, you might say, in which some really important seminal ideas are formulated. And he has this idea of art as redemption, as that which saves us in a world filled with terror. He uses very dark and negative language about the world, actually. You've got to realize, Nietzsche was a nihilist. He announced the death of God, not necessarily celebrating the fact, but bemoaning the kind of world that we're in, where bad stuff happens and things don't necessarily have meaning. But art can help us bear up under that terror. Art to make life bearable. And this theme of art as redemption, which Nietzsche works out, he attempts to explain why he feels human beings participate in the practice of creating art. Essentially, his argument boils down to the concept that we make art because it is the only way we have of making life bearable. So, in this sense, it's redemptive. It saves us from you know the drudgery and the terror of life. In making this claim, he also suggests that there are two distinctly different approaches to how we create art. The first is the Apolline art, which is art created to celebrate an ideal existence. And you see here this upper intellectual sort of thing. It's the more rational side, you might say. The best of all possible worlds of human life. So the artistry of the best possible world, depicting the world as ideal as possible. And on the other side, you have artistry, which is Dionysian. Now, the Apollos and Dionysius, these are Greek gods. Nietzsche is much, let's say, well-versed in Greek mythology. And Apollos is the more headstrong of the gods. Dionysus appeals to the underbelly, you know, the raw emotion, the gut, the senses, etc. And Dionysian art overpowers our senses in such a way that it makes us feel part of a greater whole. You might reference something like the sense of ecstasy, of, you know, the ecstatic. That's this more gut-driven, raw, emotional zone. And Nietzsche eventually concludes that Dionysiac art is the more redeeming of the two forms. Although he thinks Apolline art has its place and is necessary, he says Dionysiac art, this more, you know, raw gut emotional thing, that's the more redemptive form. He then goes on to talk about the establishing of the Olympians. If any of you enjoyed the books of this contemporary author that writes children's stories about the Greek mythologies, Percy Jackson, yes, that talks a lot about these half gods, the Olympians. Now, Nietzsche says this raising up of the Olympians as sort of ideal overhumans, Übermensch. These more powerful, more perfect version of themselves. Looking for the best they could possibly be, etc. He attaches this to people who are busy with artistry. And there's something notably dark about this. Elevating in a secularized world where you've lopped off God, elevating art to one of those places where you can get a better form of humanness, one that's more in touch and that's capable of sort of redeeming humanity in the midst of the terror, seems to be a set of ideas that is formed. And the Übermensch language of Nietzsche is for the first time formulated in this treatise, The Birth of Tragedy. It's the first time that he talks about the overhuman, the Übermensch. And it's in relationship to doing artistry and being able to. Now, you may sometimes have wondered, how is it possible that Hitler, with his rather short posture and very dark hair, etc., considered himself somehow part of, an Übermensch, Aryan race kind of thing, while the ideal seemed to be one of blonde hair and blue eyes and very large people or something like that, you know? How did he match those two things? Take note. Hitler was an art student. He went to art academy. And he will undoubtedly have been being exposed to the Nietzschean vernacular, which was very popular in the day. Now, there's been a lot of writing about Nietzsche's views on power, on courage, on letting the mighty ones rule it over the rest to get a better world, etc. But it is very noteworthy that this Übermensch idea is first distilled and formulated in his thinking about artistry as a way to connect to a higher form of humanness. And I think for somebody like Hitler, it's not unthinkable that this will have been the connection. And so, I give it as a kind of chilling warning for not elevating something to a place that it should not have into this religious realm. Now, does that mean that I think art has no relationship to redemption? Far from it. So pinpointing, as I have done with my references to Rothmeister's concerns about elevating the artist into this prophetic role, and referencing Nietzsche as an example of where it can get really dangerous, Does this mean that I think art has no redemptive role? Not at all. This is a painting by a contemporary artist, Paul Mitchell, Industrial City Skyline 2. He does many works of city skylines, different color palettes. Let me ask you, what do you think of this painting? Or, let's be honest, it's a projection of a painting. The colors are slightly different here than they are in the real work.
But it is warm.
Yes. Yes, warm, inviting. I like those words. For me, it does the same thing. That's why I chose this one. But. What do you say?
More beautiful than reality.
It is more beautiful than reality. Absolutely. Huh? Up there?
I say, I squint and see a beautiful landscape, but I open my eyes and it's full of things that are not part of the beautiful landscape.
Yes.
It's the whole intention that, like, it's not attractive in itself, but it's made attractive. So yes. You have to look at it, but it's showing reality in a harsh way.
Yeah. I like the color palette, I have to say. I like the silhouette-y kind of light effect that is being used. You know, there's a certain hour of the day, photographers often call it the golden hour, when everything turns beautiful. Beautiful and ugly alike becomes more beautiful than it is at other moments in the day. Now, this kind of painting, already ever since the Industrial Revolution, you've had artistry that does it. Somebody like the English painter Turner, you know, with his steam engines across the landscape and that sort of thing, has this fascination with the impact of technology, etc. Here you have smokestacks everywhere. This is cityscape, but it's not the dystopic cityscape of Blade Runner, you know, of just terror. No, even in a smoke-filled, industrialized context, there is beauty to be had. Mm-hmm. And this is a painting. I wouldn't mind putting this on my wall. Mm-hmm. Just in terms of what the visual language that it speaks does to me. And I think it's demonstrative of seeing the beautiful even in a broken world, trying to recapture it maybe even. Mm-hmm. And one of the people I was reading as I prepared my lecture is Brian Godawa. He's a script writer for movies. And he lives in California. I happen to have had a few moments of personal contact with him. He was the one who made the movie To End All Wars. Some of you may have seen it anyway. He says about the redemptive characteristic of artistry, that there is this potential for it to try to recover what has been lost. You ever heard the term paradise lost? It's like a theme. That's what happened at the beginning of creation. You had a perfect world and a paradise-like world in which Adam and Eve, etc., were living, and then it was lost. But we get to look forward to a recovery of paradise. You know what Jesus says to the guy on the cross next to him at the crucifixion, the one who responds positively to him? You will be with me in paradise today. It's a legitimate line. And so the attempt to see and find the good and beauty, even in things that are otherwise quite messed up, It's a good endeavor. It's an expression of at the very least, a longing. Now, there's a difference between expressing a heartfelt longing and having that warm our hearts and saying, I can recreate a perfect world. And there has been some artistry that has tried the reconstruction of reality. And we'll get to that in a moment. In my readings, I, amongst other things, read some of the stuff of Roger Scruton. And he says, art has the ability to redeem life by finding beauty even in the worst aspect of things. I think that this is such a painting. That's sort of what I have in mind when I hear him. He says further, creativity is not enough. The skill of the true artist is to show the real in the light of the ideal and so transfigure it. It's quite nicely formulated, this. He's not saying that it remakes, you know, into a new reality or something. He says, show the real, huh? An industrialized society that's polluting the earth, in light of the ideal. And by doing that, there is this, we get to see the way it could be, or long for the beauty that is actually there still to be found in the details, etc., etc. I like this formulation. Patrick Sherry writes a booklet with the title Images of Redemption, Art, Literature, and Salvation. And he's writing as a Christian, reflecting on the impact of art. And Sherry doesn't question the extent of the church's influence on the art, but turns it around and asks if art deepen our understanding of church doctrine, and in particular of soteriology. What is soteriology? That's soter is savior in Greek, so it's about redemption. Does it deepen our understanding of Christ's project of restoring paradise, you might say, of restoring the world, redeeming it? Sherry proposes that the artist or writer can show us the possibility of a transformed world. So, not capable of transforming the world, but of showing us the possibility of a transformed world. And that can have a deep impact on us. And I think a good one. In as much as one is looking for those things that are good, and wanting to try to, either by calling out the bad and saying that's undesirable, that's grotesque, let's go looking for the good. You know, there are different ways to do this thing. It doesn't mean that you only depict beautiful stuff. It may mean that you call out the bad for what it is and say we've got to go for the opposite. So there are different ways to do that. Anyway, talking about, you know, the ability of art to impact us in a certain, in this case, redemptive way, I don't want to be misunderstood to be picking on a certain functionalism or a functionality of art, and thereby trying to say art becomes okay or meaningful or valuable when it fulfills a certain function. And so I grab back to another part of Hans Rauchmeister's writing in this treatise, Art Needs No Justification. It's been published in various different forms. It's a nicer cover than this one. But he writes the following. Art has its own meaning as God's creation. It does not need justification. Its justification is being a God-given possibility. And it's he's guarding against us saying, well, art is worthwhile because it has this or that function. You know, it's useful for spreading the gospel, or it's useful for restoring our view of this thing, or it's useful for, etc. All those things might be true and possible, but that is not why art can be legitimate. And until that point, it's a useless activity. He uses the analogy of a tree. You know, you can say a tree is valuable because wood is worth, you know, $60 per meter of plank of a certain width, or wood is valuable, trees are valuable because they provide oxygen for us to breathe, or trees are valuable because they give us shade. Now, these things might all be true, but even if you pile all these things together, all these functionalities, you still haven't captured the essence of why a tree is a wonderful thing. In the first place, it's a wonderful thing because the Creator designed it and made it. And all these other functions, values, meanings, they flow out of this intrinsic meaning, which is more than the sum of the parts. You would, just with all these parts, I could have a gas tank that emits oxygen, and, you know, planks as planks, not in their tree form, used in furniture, and so I could have all the components, and I still wouldn't have a tree. You know, that's this functional reduction. And he uses it as an analogy for artistry. He says, art is good, it's worthwhile, because God made it possible. Sorry, I need to find... art does not need justification. Nobody has to be excused for making art. The artist does not need justification, just as a butcher, a gardener, or a taxi driver, a policeman, or a nurse does not need to justify with a clever argument why they are doing their work. The meaning of their work and life is certainly not in giving an opportunity to preach or to witness, and so forth. Art has, in this way, its own meaning as God's creation. And justification, its justification is its being a God-given possibility. So, it can fulfill many functions, but it doesn't need to prove its worth before it's worth something. If we see a good work of art, it's not out of place to pray, "Thank you, Lord." After all, he made the possibility of artistry. It is a gift of God. Maybe we're thanking him for answering the prayer of an artist who asked for God's help and guidance. That's one of the options. Seeing artistry through these lenses, I think is a good one. But he warns us against aestheticism. And aestheticism means giving art a place it does not deserve. That's elevating art and the aesthetic to this by itself redemptive, prophetic, religious zone. And he says, watch out, it can be very destructive when art becomes a kind of religion. Now, again, saying on one side, watch out, don't, you know, try to, even in a kind of religious functionality, situate art in a way you shouldn't, can it fulfill a meaningful role in a variety of endeavors, including in the church? Oh yes, definitely it can. And Rookmarker says, we best make our songs as good as we can and our buildings as beautiful as we can. That's, you know, if it's one of the options, maybe that's a worshipful way to be getting busy with being church. And you'll notice that there's no, you know, big criticism of people who spent lots of time making beautiful buildings or something like that. There's a certain functionalism which has crept into much of evangelical Christianity that looks as buildings, as a shell for, you know, the real thing to happen inside, but completely devoid of any intrinsic meaning itself. And I'll be honest with you, my emotional states are very much influenced and defined by the things I see and hear. And please, if I am to be reminded of, you know, the echo of God's presence in his creation, please do that as well as you can. So I'm all with him on this one. Okay. Now, I'm now moving into looking at artworks and their ability, what they can do to, inform, on the one hand, our understanding of various areas of life, including of theology, but also of many other things. And I promised in my introduction, or the announcement of this lecture, that I would use examples from Rembrandt to Kandinsky and beyond. So I thought let's start with Kandinsky. We'll start at the end of that example, or of artists. And Kandinsky is known for being one of those fathers of abstract art. He played a very crucial role in the shift away from figurative art to one which is not just depicting something, but in a sense you might link it to a rather full expression of an artist not just mirroring something outside, but really projecting something from within. You might ask the question of exactly what all is happening with abstraction, but that's one of the spaces. But interestingly, in 1896, this is very early, just think Mondrian only really starts painting more abstract stuff, you know, 10 years later or a little bit more later than this. So Vasily Kandinsky, he says the following after seeing a painting of Monet's of a haystack. Have you guys ever seen Monet's paintings? It's like this wash of, you know, pastelish color. It's like, what is this I'm looking at? You know, it's pretty fuzzy on the impressionistic sort of side of romantic paintings. Anyway, he says the following: that it was a haystack, the catalogue informed me. I could not recognize it. This non-recognition was painful to me. I considered that the painter had no right to paint indistinctly. This is an experience that many people have when confronted with abstract art. It has no right to be indistinct. Come on, tell me what it is. He's honest about it. This was his first tack, so I like it. That Kandinsky, the father of abstract art, shares our experience, at least our naive experience, coming to abstract artistry. I duly felt that the object of the painting was missing. this is a critical sensation. It's a critical sensation, I think, many believing people interacting with abstract art have this sensation quite primary. The object of this art is missing. But he goes on, and I noticed with surprise and confusion that the picture not only gripped me, but impressed itself ineradicably on my memory. It burnt itself into my skull, he says. So I was frustrated with it, and it didn't let me go. And there you have this. You see, artists want to impact their viewer. They like to communicate. That's why they're spending the time. And he discovered that this thing was communicating with him somehow. It had made an indelible impression on him. But it impressed itself ineradicably on my memory. Painting took on a fairy tale power and splendor. Now, mythos has it, and I don't know whether it's true, but it has it that one of the steps in Kandinsky's journey to making abstract art more fully was an experience where one day he returned to his atelier, to his painting studio, and one of his artworks had slipped, sometimes you hang it on a string or something, and it had rotated and come to be hanging sort of angled upside down. And as he walked into his studio and looked at it, he for a moment thought it was somebody else's painting and not his own work. You know, the upside down world, he didn't immediately recognize it, and he saw some things in that painting, started to wonder about them, and then realized, oh, it's my painting. Turned it around. But that experience opened the door to seeing other things than those things that were explicitly intended in the painting more fully. It opened this category for him. So, it's time to look at stuff, guys. This is an early 1906. So we're talking exactly 10 years after that experience of estrangement with the Monet. This is a time frame when abstract art is not yet happening. What do you see here? Come on. It's not that complicated. Huh? Horses. Okay, a horse. Clearly a horse. It's figurative art. You can see it's a horse.
Lake.
Two people. Quite a romantic scene. Water, yes, except this is figurative art. It is with a almost Pointillist-like character to it, though there are different kinds of brush techniques used throughout the color. It's interesting geometrization of the sky part. So you have some sort of moves that are happening around Kandinsky in this time, also expressed here, but He is still making figurative art here. This is not yet abstract in the fuller sense. But what he has become famous for is this kind of stuff. I think, no, this is already 1923, so this is quite a few years later. He's developed his style fully. He made lots and lots of this kind of work. If anything, it's an invitation to think your own thoughts about it, huh? As you look at this transverse line, he doesn't help us a whole lot. If you look at many of the titles of his paintings, multiple circles, lines. I mean, he gives this kind of, you know. He's not pointing towards, oh, this is actually, you know, a deconstructed bicycle or something like that. No. He's not giving you any cues as to what you're supposed to be thinking as you look at this. If anything, the title makes you wonder, is this the transverse line? Or is it that one? Or maybe, yeah, no. you have a lot of space. There's an invitation. There is an interesting color palette. I sort of like the colors in this painting. Huh? It's a good combination, this kind of slightly deeper royal blue with the oranges, you know, in tension, and then some greens that are not too articulated. It's an interesting collection of color. But we get to think our thoughts. To have our own ideas and feelings, etc. Now, I don't think that this paint is doing as much violence or something like that. But the fact that an artist comes up with and chooses to depict what we see here is maybe informing us about what's going on in the hearts and minds of a culture. It's a point that Rokemaker works out in great detail in his book Modern Art and the Death of a Culture, where he says, you know, whether we are very aware or not of it as people making art, one is expressing the way you think and see the world. Your worldview somehow is resonating. We are committed creatures, and we can be none other. But this is the choice of you know, his life's work and his labor. It says something about the relationship with those objects of creation out there that we might want to depict. There's a choice to not depict them all too explicitly, but to leave an awful lot of space for our fantasy to fill in the blanks. And so, well, one might observe something of a fragmentation in terms of our perspective and relationship with reality. It might be fair to say that. That's not a critique of Kandinsky's finesse and artistry. Far from it. It's saying he is making something visible which is alive in culture. And it is fair to look, listen, and learn from what he is depicting and how he's choosing to depict it. Now, a very different example. I'm going to come back to what happens subsequently in the realm of abstraction in the 20th century. But before I do that, I just want to mention a few examples, and they are very well-known examples. I've chosen the easy ones, of what artistry can do for us in terms of its impact on our understanding of the world. This is The Prodigal Son by Rembrandt van Rijn. As always, directional light. Who was it the other day in Utrecht? We were looking at one of the paintings on the wall there, which clearly was illustrating Rembrandt's directional light. Yeah? There's a light source coming from, so there are all sorts of wonderful aspects, this interdoor, held in light color palette, lots of dark spaces, highlighting things, etc. And, yeah, if you see the title, Prodigal Son, you start interpreting for yourself and you think, well, this probably is the prodigal son, foreground, tatters, now the shoes are worn to bits. He's just come back from, you know, being in that place where he was munching on pig food, you know, and this will be the father, no doubt. And you might, as you go further, have ideas about some of the vaguer characters. The brother, probably, you know, also the same British road colour as his dad, so an important one in the setting there, and so forth. You can have all sorts of thoughts about this painting and then move on. Or you might, because there's this part so centrally situated, you know, with the light falling. Look at the hands, you know, look at the hands. This painting is screaming at us in terms of its composition. I'll put Genesis 1, verse 26. Rembrandt is giving a commentary on the character of God, on our understanding of who he is. And God created man in his image. He created them male and female. He created them. And this image of God, which is expressed in the full palette of the diversity of the human family. And so, looking at those hands, yes, lovely, slender, feminine version, and this exaggerated, chunky, you know, masculine hand with the thumb almost, you know, just to make sure we don't miss the point, very masculine hand, you know, nice contrast there. Yeah, what's in the hands? It's a commentary on the character of God. And it's one of those things, if you've ever had the privilege of reading Henry Nouwen's Eindelijk Thuis, his booklets reflecting on this painting that he spent a long time looking at when he was in St. Petersburg. It's an observation. This painting and this detail can grow on us and really help us reread and hear Genesis more explicitly. You know, the language of the fatherhood of God is used in Scripture, but we should never confuse it with losing the basic, deep truth that humanness in her and his full expression is the image of God in us, well distributed throughout all our character traits. Anyway, a wonderful commentary, a very powerful way of deepening our insight and understanding. Another example which I've used in another lecture, Pieter Bruegel de Oude, 1520 to 1569. This is a painting of the scene, the birth story of John the Baptist in the desert. What desert? This is not a desert. What has he done? He's taken the narrative of John the Baptist, who is busy like one shouting in the desert, and he has put John the Baptist, I'm going to zoom in a moment so we get to see it closer. He's put John the Baptist in the middle there. And you know, what was happening? There's Protestant Reformation. There were all sorts of illicit hagepreken sermons happening in little forest wooded areas because it was illegal. And this is in the northern part of Belgium. And apparently, Pieter Bruegel was attending some of these hagepreken, curious by the event. And so what he does is he takes this biblical narrative and makes it appropriate to his moment in time. He situates it in his moment of history. Having been at such a hagepreek, a sermon in the woods, an illicit sermon, he puts it into modern-day vernacular, making the story relevant to his moment in time, raising all sorts of questions about the moment. But he goes... He goes a lot further. Let me ask you, as you look at this painting, what do you see? What does anything stand out to you? It has a hugely multi-culti sort of feeling. I mean, if this is an appropriation of this narrative into the north of Belgium around 1540, 1550, whatever, whenever he's painting this, my goodness, what a panoply of very ethnic-looking different kinds of, you know, garbs and individuals, especially in Europe of that moment, way too much. This is commentary. It's commentary on the text. You have the echoes of the end of Matthew, go to the ends of the earth, Christ breaking open the gospel away from just the Jewish nation to all peoples of the earth. You could fill in with all sorts of ideas, but it's clear he's saying something about the diversity of humanity here with this message that one. And there's some interesting details in this painting. If we zoom in this way, you see the hands? They are pointing in a certain direction. Which direction are they pointing?
Our Lord is depicted here.
That makes it all the more an interesting and touching depiction. Let's read. It's a prophecy that comes from Isaiah 40. Hear the voice of one calling in the desert. Make way, a path for the Lord through the desert. Make straight in the wilderness a path for our God. Anyway, people are like grass, but the Lord blows over them. Let me just grab my English Bible and we will read in 1 John. The verses as this prophecy comes back talking about John the Baptist. So verse 23. John replied in the words of Isaiah the prophet, I am the voice of one calling in the desert, make straight the way for the Lord. Now some Pharisees who had been sent question him, why then do you baptize if you are not the Christ, nor Elijah, nor the prophet? I baptize with water, John replied, but among you stands one who you do not know. Among you stands one whom you do not know. He's just part of the audience, but he's more than just part of the audience. And holy references there. Okay. He is the one who comes after me, the thongs of whose sandals I am not worthy to untie. Anyway, it's one of those paintings that invites us in. Oh, crowd of people, some trees. What's that in the distance? Oh, it's inside an enclosure. It slowly reels you in. As you go looking and interpreting and seeing, and then finally the details jump out at us.
In some ways, what that painting?
In a certain way, but figurative in the sense that you recognize trees and people and so forth. But in terms of the way the message, looking at Pieter Bruegel, he was not necessarily a Protestant follower. He probably stayed in the Roman Catholic vernacular of his time. But nonetheless, he's intrigued by this phenomenon, and he's using the vibe and the energy that people will have understood when they saw his painting as something which informs this historical event. So he's using all sorts of parts, bringing them together in a wonderful combination, asking for interpretation and the question, what does this mean? It's challenging the viewer to that thing. Okay, another example in the religious vein. This is a painting of Vincent van Gogh. Yeah, what do we see? Pleasant colors.
Paris cafe. And starry lit night. The palette should be bluer than it is in this depiction. But there's something odd about this painting. Why in the world would Vincent van Gogh do the effort to paint a setting like this with so little in the foreground, with only fuzzy, teeny little depictions of people in the back half of the cafe? Couldn't he have chosen a better moment, one that brought the liveliness of the moment a bit more? You know, you start to ask that kind of question. Until
you look at what's really
in the middle of this painting, the focal point, you see that there's a little use of the window as a cross behind one rather highlighted figure, and if you start counting little balls, you count enough of them to be disciples, with one significant, rather dark one busy leaving the scene, a Judas-like character, etc. So, you know, you have here a religious layer, and there's something, you know, when viewing an artwork, the moment of discovery, you know, it's just a nice depiction, and you might even have noticed that all the lines seem to, you know, in terms of the perspective, they do focus on this focal point. But the moment of actually seeing this layer, which has been put in there, is illustrative of the joy of interpretation of art, which, when it happens, somehow gets to draw our attention, to refocus our attention.
I also like that the chairs in the front, they are very inviting for you to sit.
Come
on.
And sit down.
They're not like the other ones,
yeah,
close
nice
to the table, but they're open.
Cool. Yeah. I never thought about the chairs in the front, so you open my eyes again. This moment happens. The next time I look at this painting, I will see that. Huh? That's fun. I mentioned Brian Godawa, who I had the privilege of speaking to once upon a time. I'm very impressed by some of the scenarios he's written. I do worry, though, that his movie To End All Wars became too explicit. It's a war movie about a situation of a prisoner of war camp in the Far East, where one of the prisoners sacrifices himself so that the others are not punished, and ends up getting killed. But how that prisoner gets killed is on a cross, and it's just one step too explicit. So you have this theme of sacrifice and the echo of Christ in that sacrifice in the context. Very powerful movie. Spared no expense. Kiefer Sutherland is the main actor, etc. But there's too little space for me as a viewer and interpreter to do the interpreting. And it's one of those things about artistry. If we're talking about abstraction, for art to be able to charm us, it needs to allow us, to afford us the space to do the discovery. If it's too much sort of taking a message and sort of pushing it in your face, you know, not giving us any space to come to it and have this dialogue with it. I'm very fond of movie discussion, because in discussing movies after you've watched the film, you often discover things that you didn't see, and subsequently, once the dominoes start to fall, so you've just watched, say, for example, Interstellar, science fiction movie, you know, high-powered, big, epic, long movie, wow, you know, gravity, and all sorts of weird, wild, wonderful themes. And then somebody says, as the discussion starts, yeah, why do you think he chose 12 guys to go to the New Worlds? 12. Oh. You know, the 12 disciples, 12 tribes. Ooh, maybe there's a religious layer here. Let's go take a look again. You know, and all of a sudden the dominoes start to fall. Dr. Mann, the one who drew people to the planet, but was, you know, had this fundamental flaw of his own anxiety and fear about loneliness, making him lie to people, etc., etc. Now, that process, not in your face, but explicit enough that you can find it if you really go looking for it. Huh? That's the sweet spot. So there's, yeah, this not being too explicit is actually one of the hallmarks of good artistry. It is pointing towards something without fully depicting it often, which is such a pleasant experience as we interact with artistry. We had the privilege as Artway. By the way, if you've never discovered Artway, it's a website well worth delving into. We have the privilege of having the conceptualizer, the maker of Artway with us, with Marlene here this morning. Artway brought an exposition to the Netherlands titled The Stations of the Cross, having a number of artworks from all over the world brought together in the Netherlands, depicting different stations or stadia of the crucifixion, but then in a very sort of associative kind of vernacular in different spots. And one of those that I really am very fond of the artworks there, was Hansa Versteeg's Madonna del Mare Nostrum. Madonna, child and mother, you see in the way those two faces are put together. But you have this curious thing. This thermal blanket. Foreboding waters, but the thermal blanket. At a moment when we've just seen lots of images of people, refugees, Mediterranean Sea, being wrapped in thermal blankets because they had their boat sink and needed to be rescued, etc., etc. And this is artistry that is taking a theme like, you know, the reference to the Madonna. It's for me posing this question: foreboding, dangerous waters. The sky is not a very friendly one. Serves well to depict, sort of, to frame it. But it's posing questions like, hey, you religious people, should you maybe be taking notice of the plight and the suffering of a large group of hurting people you see passing by on your television screens day by day? Maybe that has something to do with your religiously motivated sentiments, etc. It's in some ways ethical art. It's calling us to apply our emotional sensibilities, our religious sensibilities to what's happening in the world, making an appeal. And art can do that too. It can awaken and challenge us with the gravitas and the meaning of things. This is one of my favorites. What do you see here? Yeah. It often takes a little while. Blowing up this on a large screen, maybe more quickly we see it. But, you know, you start looking at this and you wonder what's that. That's the middle of the thing. What's that fuzzy thing? If you see the title, it becomes a little more clear. Jerusalem, okay, Temple Mount, etc. And then, oh, the cross. You know, you have the shadow of the cross here. And it's Jean-Léon Gérôme, 1867. He's giving us such a subtle and respectful rendition of the crucifixion. I love what this does. In contrast to us sort of standing there, you know, ogling the cross, looking at, you know, the blood pouring off of Jesus or something like that, he's putting us closer to the foot of the cross and looking at which impact it is having on the world. The world is being lit up by this cross. A dark world that needs lighting up, needs salvation. What a wonderful depiction of the crucifixion. I've preached for Easter sermons with the title The Shadow of the Cross and this illustration more than once. And there's a clear power to the message folded in here, giving us new eyes to reflect on not just the fact that it happened, but what it means for the world. So this is a kind of drawing us in to reflect on, and what did it mean? So, looking at the clock, we have 45 minutes left. I'm going to go quite rapidly through the next set of six slides and then slow down for my last two slides. When I was looking at Kandinsky and abstraction in art, you have, Kandinsky's own journey, a kind of journey of discovery. Now, Mondrian is maybe even more explicit and deliberate about what it is that he wants to achieve with his abstractions. It is not happenstance that when you walk through IKEA, you see, you know, 13 different renditions of Mondrian prints on trays and stuff. He was very self-consciously making the wallpaper for our lives, something that was aspiring to shape the spaces that we live in, to redraw the map of the world we live in. He was born in 1872, died in 1944. So just a little after Kandinsky in terms of the time frame. And he is representative of a shift which was taking place. European art up to that point, just think of the Vermeer exposition, which is happening at the Rijks at the moment. Lots of references to cultural history and all the buildings and the way the landscapes are painted. Lots of nostalgia for the beauty of the past, etc. And this is typical of European art, referenced to nature, tradition, nostalgia, detail, etc. And Mondrian is representative of a transition, one which tries to fight free from these historic illusions, traditions, and ultimately from nature. Now, 1901, Mondrian was still painting this sort of stuff. This is figurative art. Huh? An idyllic, very Dutch setting. Huh? Knotwilgen, a little bit of water, landscape that's rather flat as a pancake. Few cows. We've lots of cows here. It's idyllic. It's just, and in a kind of romantic vernacular, though you might say that the brushstroke technique is already moving in a more impressionist vein. 1901. That's where Mondrian was at. But in 1903, he writes these words. Dat komt niet in de natuur voor, maar het is toch geschapen. Het is als wij erover denken. It does not exist in nature, but it is created. It's when we think about it. It's a kind of discovery that
our creative purview space is not limited. It's not, you know, it's not tied to the things that are there in nature. So he's sort of eking out intellectually a space for going where nature has not gone, not just depicting figurative things that already exist, but producing, in a sense, a remade world. He's actually breaking open the space for this thing, 1903. And his landscapes, they are a kind of witness to a kind of reconstructing project, heroically going to, you know, towards what ultimately came to be called neoplasticism, the newer building, where people were, they saw themselves as remaking the world. You know, this was a time frame, 1910 to 1920, upheaval politically here in the Netherlands, ultimately the lead into the First World War, 1919, etc. Now, 1908, this is not yet full-on abstraction. Whose work does this remind you of? Van Gogh, absolutely. This clear echoes, you know, you have this brush-stroking sort of technique thing. But there's a difference. What's noteworthy about this? Yellow, red and blue, the primaries. The building blocks, the toolkit with which all colors are made, sort of thing. You know, he's already in the zone of the constructor's toolkit, and limiting himself to that, not depicting any of the colors that we find the mixed colors of nature, the greens, the browns, etc. That was 1908, and then 1909. This is a depiction of dunes with beach. And the view from the pier. You can sort of figure out, you know, sky, dunish color, water, you know, it's pretty vague. And you see a kind of geometrization taking place. You have lines and little blocks of color and geometric, you know, shapes. And that geometrization sets through, 1913, a few years later, he's had to flee the Netherlands because as an anarchist he'd been protesting against the police in Amsterdam and they wanted to incarcerate him. So his friends told him, you better get out of here. Mondrian was a drift kicker, one who, with a lot of pathos was doing what he was doing. This is a depiction of a tree. What has he done? He's got this geometrization, but now just to emphasize the point, the abstraction, he's put lines around every geometric form to the point where you can't really vaguely see some sort of branching thing, but it's become very, very vague. And he pushes the envelope. He keeps going. This is a painting which hangs in the Kruger Müller Museum. And this too is a next step, a next work in the depiction of a tree. But my gosh, he's taken abstraction to a new level. He's gotten rid of the color. Just the lines, and he doesn't have the geometric forms fully encircled anymore, just as part of the lines. So he's new, and it's this, you know, the first time I saw this without knowing anything about it, I thought, what is this, a lens? Or, you know, what? It still has a bit of depth, huh? You see the depth, the sort of, it looks almost spherical, and some motion to it, there's a kind of bit of movement. In the way this, so you have the movement of the tree that gets its life from the ground, but it's coming to a halt. The geometric is slowly taking over. From 1917 onwards, all the references to nature have disappeared from his work, and progressively depth also, and movement. And so you're left with the constructor's color palette, the primary colors, and geometric structure. And this is the Mondrian we know so many paintings of, what fills IKEA.
This was 1921.
Signed with a simple PM. Recht to recht on. Paintings of which many a naive art viewer says, hey, I could have done that. Yeah, but could you have come up with the abstraction which has precipitated him getting to this point? And did you have his narrative about why you chose the primaries and positive and negative space, black and white? Why, you know, redrawing the lines for reality. Now, he moved to the States. You get in the States the neoplasticists. Barnett Newman was the leader of the group at a certain point, and he makes this huge, huge painting. Who's afraid of red, yellow, and blue? Number three. Why number three? Exactly, but then not just another two. A knife that
in the museum somebody took a knife to.
So the spectators of this very aggressive, you know, massive big red thing in the museum, sort of blue and yellow. Yeah, the primaries. These are our toolkit. Who's afraid of it? We're gonna boldly remake the world. I'm gonna show you a quote of Barnett Newman. In 1948, he writes in an essay titled The Sublime Is Now the following. We are freeing ourselves of the impediments of memory, association, nostalgia, legend, myth, or what have you, that have been the devices of Western European painting. Instead of making cathedrals out of Christ, man, or life, we are making it out of ourselves, out of our own feelings. Wow. Pretty in your face as a formulation of what he is out to do with these primary colors. It's to, you know, sort of remake the world from within us after two world wars, sort of to try to overcome maybe the problem of evil or something like that with, you know, with a recreated world. Well, you know, judging from the world anno 2023, abysmal images of a Russian-Ukrainian war on our television every evening. Unfortunately, not much has come of the project of purifying our world from evil. Our best attempts at reconstructing are pretty shoddy. Maybe a little bit much, making it out of ourselves and out of our own feelings. Maybe there's a bit of hubris there. So yes, we can view this artistry and see it as an embodiment, as a cultural expression of what's happened with the hearts and minds as we try to move away from nature and history, trying to free ourselves from some of the heartbreak and the pain of evil. But redemption ultimately needs a real redeemer. And that, my dear friends, is not found in our feelings, but found in our Lord Jesus Christ. The one who suffered without blemish on our behalf. Before my closing slide, my favorite definition of art. There are as many definitions of art as there are people who write about art. There's apparently a lot of space for us to have our thoughts in this realm too, but I like this one. And it's a specifically one word that really catches my attention. I've said the referring nature of art in this definition. Art is an object or event conceived and structured by human design to be perceived by our senses and characterized by an imaginative and elusive finish that affords the piece its own independent identity. Now, this is a neologism. This is not a word that normal English people use. We're not talking about elusive, but allusive. It alludes to, het verwijst naar, things. I think it's very important. Yeah, that art needed an imaginative vernacular. We all understand that it needs to have a specific kind of identity and that it appeals to our senses and so forth. But that it alludes to something outside itself, I think is very important. And I think it's true that the ability of an artwork to point towards something, and please not fill it in too much, give me a little space to interpret, that is indeed elusive. It's like this mix of elusive and eluding. that's what I read in his word there. Conclusion. The artist, not necessarily a prophet or a savior, but talented lookers, viewers, observers, who see and not only see, but are also capable of expressing, putting into image, you might say, incarnating what they see, and in so doing, maybe help us to see those things too. That was my contribution.